should have standards in place that ensure that if people come here through a guided fishing options, that it's on par with those other world-class destinations in the world.
A push for more regulation of sport fishing guides. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a mystery chemical that made Fort Wainwright workers sick remains a mystery.
Not in anywhere near the concentration that would cause acute effects. So we didn't find anything, no smoking gun.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of the 159 Alaska organizations that provide help to individuals and families affected by a disability or mental illness. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and the Friends of the Alaska Children's Trust.
The state will run a disaster assistance center in Savoonga to help residents whose homes were damaged after a storm caused prolonged power outages. The center will operate at the Village City Hall next week. Jeremy Zydek with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security says state assistance specialists will help. In late December through early January, a severe winter storm brought high winds and cold temperatures to the community on St. Lawrence Island. Salt water froze on electrical transmission lines, causing power outages, which led to frozen and broken water pipes. A bill that would create an independent board regulating licensed sport fishing guides is gaining ground in the Alaska Senate. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
The bill was pre-filed by Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican. Senators have now moved the bill up into the Senate Resources Committee. Proponents argue that sport fishing guides should be held to a set of professional standards by those within the guide industry. McGuire's bill would establish a sport fishing guide services board to write regulations and create proficiency exams. Five of the board's nine members would be licensed guides. Already the bill has a support from industry groups.
Alaska is comparable to any sport fishing destination in the world, and we should have standards in place that ensure that if people come here on a through a guided fishing options, that it's on par with those other world-class destinations in the world.
That's Ricky Gies, executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. He says the current system, in which licenses are overseen by the state's Department of Commerce and Economic Development, is inadequate for such a complex sector like sport fishing.
There's no minimum accountability standards if something goes wrong. I think there also is a benefit to self-regulation and a regulatory framework that provides that. So I think the guided issues will be better served by a professional services board than what we have right now.
Sport fishing guides aren't unregulated. Since 2004, there have been minimum standards that includes things like requiring liability insurance and first aid training. Guides are also required to log their clients' catch and provide this data to fish and game biologists. Previous efforts to pass permanent legislation have failed, and the past two legislatures have granted one-year extensions. So if no action is taken during the 90-day session, all of these requirements will expire at the end of the year. Sport fishing is big business. A report from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game says that anglers spent $1.4 billion in 2007 alone. That figure may have decreased in the past 3 years, but Fish and Game's Sport Fish Division Director Charles Swanton says sport fishing's economic impact is significant.
You know, it's probably lower with the the effects that we've seen with downturns in the national, international economic situations over the course of the last couple of years. But it's still, I would still say it certainly is a billion-dollar industry anyway.
As to the merits of the bill itself, Swanton says the agency isn't ready to weigh in.
We have not had an opportunity to run through it line by line and look at such things as fiscal costs associated with it to the individual guides, guide businesses, how it may affect sport fishing throughout the state as it related to guided sport fishing.
Many professions in the state have their own professional boards. Big game hunting guides were recently added to the list of state boards with the addition of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. Board members are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
A long-awaited report is inconclusive on what sickened construction workers at Fort Wainwright in 2006. The draft report on the Hangar 6 incident by state and federal health agencies was released after a public records request from an attorney and subsequently published online by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility and the online news site Alaska Dispatch. Former State Public Health Department toxicologist and study co-author Dr. Lori Verbrugge confirms the workers were exposed to a toxic chemical, but says the investigation found no clear culprit.
The most common things were things that, you know, you see all over, you know, various military bases and other sites, but mostly fuel-related things. So, you know, benzene, toluene, that sort of thing, the various components of fuel, and not in anywhere near the concentration that would cause acute effects. So we didn't find anything, no smoking gun.
35 workers reported nausea, dizziness, and headaches following the unearthing of odorous, chalky-tasting vapors during grading of a parking area outside the aircraft hangar construction site in June 2006. Subsequent health problems included blood in urine, memory loss, fatigue, sore throat, and tingling skin. Most of the workers eventually recovered, but four continue to claim health problems stemming from the incident. Verbrugge says doctors also tried to backtrack a cause from the symptoms.
You know, we really tried to match the symptoms with the chemicals that were on the site, and we could not find a single chemical that, you know, would be probable of causing the different effects that were seen.
Verbrugge says she unsuccessfully searched more than 10,000 pages of soil chemical analysis reports trying to find something.
But just because we couldn't find a chemical, that doesn't mean, you know, that there wasn't one. We really suspect that the causative chemical evaporated and it simply wasn't in the environment later when they went and tested.
The state report cites a lack of on-site air monitoring, no field environmental screener, and failure to halt work upon initial complaints about illness. It recommends retaining pavement as a cap over the site and better safety plans and equipment and an awareness about the toxic legacy at the 70-year-old Army Post. Fort Wainwright is a national Superfund toxic waste site and has a long history of contamination. A year prior to the Hangar 6 incident, construction workers unearthed PCBs and other toxins at the Taku Gardens housing site. The Army did not get back in time to comment on the issue. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, people opposed to the Chewitna mine speak out to try to stop it.
And now I know what it's like to be the most unpopular guy in a room.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Rasmussen Foundation is announcing a March 1st deadline to apply for Individual Artist Awards, which provides funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of the informational teleconferences open to the public to be held the week of January 17. Call 297-2882 or go online at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
A Fort Richardson soldier has died in Afghanistan. 23-year-old Private First Class Amy Renee Sinkler was a motor transport operator and was killed when her vehicle was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade on January 19th. Sinkler was from Chadbourne, North Carolina. She was assigned to the 109th Transportation Company, 3rd Maneuver Enhancement Brigade at Fort Richardson. Sinkler joined the Army in August of 2009 and arrived in Alaska 1 year ago. There were three other soldiers in the vehicle, but they were not injured. Next of kin have been notified. Alaska Natives want a greater voice in federal subsistence management, in keeping with President Barack Obama's promise to consult with tribes in formulating federal regulations. The Federal Subsistence Board today took comments from tribal representatives on how to cope with an increasing gap between the needs of tribes tied to a subsistence way of life and the daily reality of dwindling resources. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Board Chair Tim Tworek mediated the Anchorage session. He heard from the well-known, like Senator Albert Kukesh.
You can't sit up there and think that you have all of the answers in your head when the people who are on the ground and who live the subsistence lifestyle know the problems and know what the answers have to be. You have to listen to them. That, to me, is what consultation's all about. Listening to the people who live the life.
And from the little known, like Crooked Creek's Evelyn Thomas.
My village is a subsistence-only village. We have no commercial fishing. We have been feeling the bite of the intense pollock fishery in Bristol Bay. If we're restricted to Mondays and Fridays to when we can catch a salmon to feed our families, it's equivalent to us going to Seattle, Washington, and standing in front of Safeway and telling them you can only go to the store on Monday and Friday.
Thomas said waste in commercial fisheries was felt way upriver in the form of tighter restrictions on villagers. And that boils down to not having enough to eat. No matter who voiced it, the message was the same. Alaska Natives feel they don't have a place at the table when it comes to federal subsistence management. Many targeted criticism at the regional advisory councils, the entities which are the interface between communities and the board, saying they do not always speak for the tribes. Willard Jackson from Ketchikan said the RACs and the subsistence board need to come to the villages and see for themselves. He said natives from smaller villages are moving to larger urban centers to receive assistance.
The native population in Anchorage is probably going to double. Our people are moving out of our villages to find a way of life because they're not finding it out in their outside areas. We no longer have herring spawning in our area. It's been fished out in the Foggy Bay.
Mike Smith, a wildlife director with the Tiananaw Chiefs Conference, said decades of wrangling between the state and the federal governments over subsistence has taken a harsh toll on natives.
The subsistence way of life is not just an idealized notion embodied in folklore. It still is alive and well in our regions. Our people depend upon it. It's very clear to me the difference between, 15 king salmon in your freezer and 10 is huge to a family of four sitting on the Yukon River, Mr. Chairman. When it comes down to it, with all the complexities of state and federal laws and jurisdictions, I always look at that family on the river, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Tworek asked speakers to provide some direction to the subsistence board on how the board needs to relate to the state of Alaska, especially to the Board of Fisheries. Peter Probosco, assistant director of the Office of Subsistence Management, says the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act recognizes all rural Alaskans. He says RACs may have many tribal members and that the board must give deference to the RACs on subsistence issues.
Keep in mind, this is the first day of working towards developing a protocol on how the federal subsistence program will work with the tribal governments in the future. Getting more involvement on a more frequent basis has been the theme that I've been hearing on most people. Just simply sending them the packet of proposals and the information the board will be dealing with hasn't been sufficient. They want more actually sitting across the table from the board.
Probosco says the challenge is working with the president's order to enhance and improve tribal consultation to bring tribes to the table and still maintain the federal subsistence program as described in ANILCA. Probosco says it is hoped that the method to do so will be worked out by the fall round of meetings. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Former Alaska First Lady Neva Egan has died at the age of 96. She was the state's very first First Lady. She passed away Wednesday night at the Juneau Pioneer Home. The wife of the late Governor Bill Egan, she was the mother of Juneau State Senator Dennis Egan. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
Bill and Neva Egan were the first residents of Alaska's governor's house after statehood from 1959 to 1966. 4 years later, he was elected to his third term as governor, and they moved into the Calhoun Avenue residence again, living there from 1970 to 1974. In an interview at the age of 90, Neva recalled those years.
We never forgot that it was the people's house, and we were privileged to live here.
Neva McKittrick came to Alaska from Kansas in 1937 to teach school in Valdez. She said she had planned to stay a year. She was one of four teachers in a school of 75 students in all 12 grades. At the time, Bill Egan was a member of the Valdez City Council. He was a Democrat, and she'd been raised a Republican. Those lines apparently blurred, and they were married in 1940. He'd been elected to the territorial legislature to represent the 3rd Judicial District, which encompassed Valdez, Anchorage, Kodiak, and the Kenai Peninsula. In those years, legislative sessions were every 2 years for 60 days. He became a major force in Alaska statehood, served as president of the Alaska Constitutional Convention in Fairbanks, and when Alaska became the 49th state, he was elected the first governor. Neva recalled that things were still pretty simple when the family moved into the governor's house in 1959. The total staff was a cleaning lady and cook.
Cook would give me a list, and I'd go down and do the grocery shopping. And one afternoon, the box boy was putting the groceries in the trunk of the car, and he looked down and saw the number one license plate. And he looked up at me, and he says, "Are you the governor's old lady?" And I said, "Yes, I guess that's my title."
Katie Hurley, her friend of more than 50 years and chief clerk of the Constitutional Convention, says it was easy for Neva Egan to be a great first lady.
Number one, she was her husband's best friend besides being his wife, and he really had an outgoing personality that fit in with being the first lady, I think, and she made the public realize that the mansion was for the public just as much as for them.
Neva loved to entertain at the governor's residence and did most of the cooking. She also did the ironing, made the beds, and even made some of the curtains. She found antique furniture from territorial days in the attic, had it repaired, and brought it into the house, which she said she believed should show its history. She also was a singing first lady. Katie Hurley says they each had a thing for the Alaska flag song. She would play the piano, and Neva, a former music teacher, would sing the state song just about everywhere they were together. One of the last times they performed was a reunion some years ago of Constitutional Convention delegates.
I don't know it by memory. I have to have the music. And she said to me, "I have the Alaska flag song in my purse in case they ask me to sing." And of course they did. And we never had to practice because we'd done it so many times. And she'd get everybody to sing with her.
Bill Egan died in 1984 at the age of 70. They had been married nearly 44 years. Neva Egan was known for her sense of humor and hearty laugh. At a 2005 gathering of Alaska's first ladies at the governor's house, all agreed she had the best stories to tell.
I answered the phone all the time, too. We didn't have anyone else. And when I get a call from outside, they were pressing for news. There had been some accident up here or something. I really couldn't give them any information. I hedged as much as I could. And they'd say, "To whom am I speaking?" And I always told the truth. I always said, "This is the housekeeper."
Details of a memorial service for Neva Egan are pending. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Restoration work is planned for two of the oldest oil wells on the North Slope. State Department of Natural Resources Northern Region Oil and Gas Team Manager Gary Schultz says ConocoPhillips Nora and Lisa exploration wells drilled in the foothills area of the North Slope date back to the late 60s, and they're scheduled for reclamation work this winter.
There's old gravel pads and inactive reserve pits. And the project is to excavate the gravel pad and an adjacent airstrip and put the gravel into the reserve pit, and then they'll cap that with organic soils to make a good growing medium for vegetation.
The reserve pits contain petroleum-based drilling muds, and Schultz says capping them traps the mud between the surface and the frozen soil underneath.
The goal of the project is to take this small pond that has drilling waste on the bottom and then cover it up so that the drilling waste is not exposed to the environment.
Schultz says the project is happening now because the 40-year-old wells have posed minimal environmental threat. An ice road off the Dalton Highway will be used to access the well sites. Southeast Alaska could lose about 400 jobs this year. That's according to a projection by the State Labor Department. But a regional economic development group is more optimistic. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
State economists project a 1% drop in regional employment in 2011. Labor Department economist Molly Abrahamson says the losses will be spread around.
The industries that are going to experience losses are primarily trade, transportation, leisure, and hospitality industries. Some decline is going to be due to temporary census worker layoffs, and then we are also forecasting a slight decline in local government.
The local government projection is due to declining school enrollment as well as overall population. However, Abrahamson says continued strong state government, mining, and healthcare sectors will help even things out. This year's drop will follow a decade of up-and-down job numbers. They've ranged from a 2.2% loss in 2009 to a 1.7% increase in 2005.
Overall, I would describe the 2000s as pretty flat, actually, as far as employment goes in Southeast, you know, kind of bumping around, staying between 36 and 37,000 jobs.
One variable is tourism, which in Southeast is dependent on cruise ships. The state report projects about 100 job losses this year due to continued lower passenger numbers and a slow nationwide economy. Others expect tourism earnings to increase this year, which could mean some job growth. Juneau Economic Development Council Executive Director Brian Holst says that's in part due to a new line. The Disney Wonder will bring about 43,000 passengers during the summer season. Holst says they're more affluent than those on some ships that left the region.
That spending that will occur in an economy that is no longer in recession, I think we're going to see the tourism industry be stable. I certainly don't see reason to suggest that we should be pessimistic for this next year compared to last year.
The Labor Department report projects a stable seafood industry this year. It counts 1,300 processing jobs in the region and says that won't change. But it doesn't tally fishermen, deckhands, or others hauling in the product. Holst says he expects earnings to be up, which could increase the sector's economic impact.
That industry is experiencing higher prices, as there seems to be many factors, but demand is up. So I think we should anticipate that in general, the seafood industry should do as well in 2011 as it did in 2010. And since that is such a large employer, that also bodes well for us.
The Labor Department expects Alaska employment to increase overall by about 1,800 jobs to more than 325,000. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
A group of Alaskans want to prevent coal mining on the west side of Cook Inlet. Delaware-based Pack Rim Coal is still in the planning process, but two groups have filed a petition with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources that would declare a certain area of the Chewitna watershed unsuitable for mining. One area the company would like to mine is beneath Middle Creek, which is a salmon-bearing stream. At a public hearing for the petition on Wednesday in Kenai, residents spoke out mostly in opposition to mining the area. KDLL's Ben Stanton has the story.
Some people speak seriously, forcefully, humorously. Some are emotional.
This is a very, very...
Judy Heilman lives in Beluga near the proposed mining area.
To see all you people here makes me cry. Thank you.
She, along with commercial and sport fishermen and other residents from as far as Anchorage, Palmer, Cordova, and Dillingham, have different ways of making similar arguments. Most argue against letting mining happen.
We can't let it happen. It'll happen on one stream and then another and then another.
This sets a dangerous precedent, one that cannot be undone.
I don't think it can be repeated often enough. If it happens here in Cook Inlet, in Anchorage's backyard, in the population center of our state, it can happen anywhere.
It's Dave Acheson, Jedediah Smith, and the last voice is Bob Shavelson, the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, which is one of the groups that brought the petition forward. That group does not agree with Pacrim Coal, who asserts they'll be able to reconstruct Middle Creek after about 25 years of mining underneath it. Many here say not so.
They say they can replace it. It's never been replaced. They can never demonstrate that.
Destroying an area like this and then thinking you can put it back together again. You know as well as I do it can't be done if you've studied anything.
It ain't going to happen. It's never happened before.
How impossible it would be to try to reconstruct a stream.
It's John Mario, Linda Filer, Kevin Walker, and Gene Parker. Others say that if you want to pick a place to not put a mine, this would be it, because it's delicate salmon habitat. It supports 5 species of salmon. And the Department of Fish and Game has described Middle Creek as significant to salmon. And several people describe a twofold detriment to fish: taking out the stream, but then that burning the coal ends up polluting the air, water, and then fish. And as Petla Noden says,
I really like fishing pretty much.
People like to eat it.
All kinds of fish prepared in all kinds of ways.
And now I know what it's like to be the most unpopular guy in a room.
Dan Graham is the project manager for the proposed Chewitna Coal Project for Pacrim Coal. He says Alaska is and will be his home, and he doesn't want to mess it up.
If we can't do this project and design it and operate it correctly, then it won't be done, at least not under my watch. The regulatory process.
Graham agrees that one resource should not be traded for another resource, but he also says the unsuitable land petition is meant to be used for land use planning and not for reviewing specific projects. Graham was the only one to speak against the petition. DNR may have an additional hearing in Tyonek. Once they have the final hearing, DNR has 2 months to make a decision on the petition. They could reject it, accept it, and deny mining permits to land in the area, or apply certain conditions to future mining operations in that area. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Rosemary Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ben Stanton in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
And by
the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.